You're listening to the Bird Dog Babe podcast with my mom, Courtney Bastian.
This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan and Boss Shot Shells.
The Invitational is a hard test to train for. Generally, less than 50% of the dogs that go pass the test. I've seen this test bring grown men and women to their knees, professional trainers, novice trainers. You know, a lot of people put a lot of heart and soul and finances into this because we all know our dogs can do it or we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't put ourselves through it to get us to that point. And it's one day that you're under judgment that we decide if your dog has earned that versatile champion title. So just be proud to the fact that you've made it and you've trained to that. To this point, you have a phenomenal dog. You're playing with the big guys. You're in the Super Bowl here when you're at the NAVDA Invitational and you're running your dog. So pass or fail, I just hope people are really proud of the fact that they're there and they did all the work to that point and then try to have fun with it.
Hey, Bird Dog Babes. My name is Courtney Bastian and I am obsessed with all things bird dogs. And I'm here to share with you the stories, experiences, knowledge, and opinions from the women and a few guys in the industry that are killing it. I'm a Wisconsin girl living in a Montana world, mom and two incredible kiddos, wife and occasional assistant to a pro gun dog trainer, traveling the U.S. talking about canine nutrition while hunting, raising, and competing with my German wire hair pointers and Brocky Italiano. As someone who started hunting later in life because I wanted to give my dogs the opportunity to do what they were bred to do, I'm here to help inspire, educate, and connect women to get their bird dogs out in the field and experience a bond like no other. So pour yourself a glass of wine and get ready to be challenged and encouraged while you learn. This is the Bird Dog Babe Podcast. This has been a really fun and informative series of the NAVDA testing system. I know you guys have been enjoying these by all the awesome feedback you're sharing and the large number of downloads they get daily. If you're training for the Invitational right now, or if you aspire to one day qualify with your dog, this episode is a must listen. Angie Coonan is back, and she's joined with Tracy Harmeyer to walk us through all aspects of the Invitational. This is NAVDA's premier hunt test, and it's held annually in September. In addition to a full overview of the test, Angie and Tracy share some excellent training advice and tips throughout that you won't want to miss. All right, let's get after it. This episode is presented to you by Purina Pro Plan. What makes a great bird dog is genetics, training, and nutrition, and that's why I feed and trust Purina Pro Plan. With over 500 nutritionists, veterinarians, and scientists on staff, ProPlan delivers a full spectrum of performance and specialized formulas to help bird dogs like yours excel at every stage of life. ProPlan supports us, the breeders, owners, and trainers, the events we compete in, our national breed clubs, canine health research, and our committed partners to conservation groups such as Pheasants Forever, Rough Grouse Society, and Ducks Unlimited. 95 out of the top 100 dogs are fueled by the advanced nutrition of Purina ProPlan. This episode is also presented by Boss Shot Shells. Copper-plated bismuth, Boss provides a better, more effective non-lead option than steel and are safe to use in Grandpa's gun. Available in 10, 12, 16, 20, 28-gauge, and 410 bore. Direct-to-consumer pricing and cases shipped directly to your door. Shoot Boss. Pattern your shotgun to make more clean and ethical shots. Reduce crippling and remove lead from the uplands, wetlands, and all lands. Find out more at BossShotShells.com. A big shout out to the people and partners that are helping me keep the MP3s rolling for this podcast. My Patreon patrons, the bread and butter, the peeps, the community of like-minded individuals that are eager to learn and offer to contribute. Join us for $5 per month on Patreon.com/TheBirdDogBabe for exclusive discounts, content, and live Q&A sessions. 5% of your contribution goes to the AKC Canine Health Foundation and another 5 goes to conservation. Dakota 283, unparalleled protection for your dog's travel to and from your next adventure. My favorite is the G3 kennel, which has a recessed handle on top that makes it easy for me to lift in and out of my truck. The keyed pedal latching door makes me feel at ease on trips when I have to leave dogs in my truck when I stop for fuel. An added bonus is the drain hole in the back, which makes cleaning a breeze when my dog has been run hard and put away wet. Go to Dakota283.com and use promo code BIRDDOGBABE for 10% off. And by Siren, shotguns for women. Siren carries the only full line of women's shotguns. They are dedicated to providing the equipment and knowledge that make shooting and hunting more enjoyable and less stressful. New or seasoned hunter, Siren offers multiple options that fit right out of the box. No more compromises. Go to SirenUSA.com and check out all the options available for upland, waterfowl, sporting, and trap shotguns. All right, we are back with our third session here on this breakdown of the NAVDA test. We had the natural ability, the utility, and the utility prep, and now we are doing the invitational test. This is the big kahuna, the big show, the ultimate test of both bird dog and trainer, the premiere, I could keep going on. It's the big one. We're here for all the stuff. So joining me on this final episode is Angie Cohen, coming back with that, has been with us for the first two, and Tracy Harmeyer is joining us for this one. So thank you, ladies, for joining me for this episode. There's a lot of details here. I'm excited to kick off with both of you. And if you could start us out with a short bio of each of you, to let our listeners know who you are, what you do, and your involvement with NAVDA.
I'm Tracy Harmeyer. I started apprenticing in NAVDA in 1992. I became a judge in 1993. So I've been doing this for a long time. I have run 156 dogs in the organization so far. I believe 7 or 8 of those have been at the Invitational. Pretty sure I passed 5 dogs so far at the Invitational level. I train dogs for a living. I have Crystal Creek Kennels in Cedar Grove, Wisconsin. And I train NAVDA dogs. I train just obedience dogs. I'm a professional groomer. I'm a 52-run boarding kennel. So pretty much dogs are my life. That's my living. And I judge maybe 3-4 tests a year. On average, I think I probably run 6 or 7 utility dogs a year. And probably maybe 6 to 8 NA dogs a year. And every once in a while, I get to pop into the Invitational. Started judging the Invitational in 2010, which I really enjoy. Really enjoy seeing things at that level. And I love talking about dogs. And I do, in NAVDA, I'm a senior judge, a clinic leader, an Invitational judge. The clinics now are called the Rules, what are they called? The Rules and Aims Clinic. And I really enjoy doing those. And I really enjoy judging. I really enjoy seeing handlers and dogs and meeting new people.
And Tracy, what's your breed of choice?
Oh, I raised mostly German Shorthairs. I had a few small Munster litters in the past, but I really enjoy the German Shorthairs. It's just what makes me happy and what I like and what I'm used to.
It looks like a beautiful sunny day in Wisconsin there. I can hear the birds chirping.
Yeah, they're making a lot of noise. Sorry about that.
No, it's okay. It sets this nice music in the background. Right. All right, Angie.
Hi, I'm Angie Coonan. I live in Richland Center, Wisconsin. I currently have Hurricane Kennels. My husband and I have been running that operation for about 10 years. I've been involved with NAVDA since 2003, but I did not become a judge until 2010. Then I became a senior judge in 2015 and an invitational judge in 2017. I'm currently sit on the board of directors for NAVDA. I am the secretary, which is an elected position. Also a lot of work. My husband and I enjoy training and working with our German Shorthair pointers. We have a nice little piece of property here that we have the opportunity to do that. So we feel very blessed and lucky to be able to train right out our back door. I've ran the Invitational twice, passed once, failed once. So I don't have quite as much experience as Tracy, but I've been heavily involved with the Invitational also as the test secretary. And now this year, sitting on the board of directors for NAVDA, the Invitational is a committee and I oversee that committee. So I'm working on it basically on a daily basis. And especially this year with it as big as it is, it's taking a lot of volunteer hours and man hours along with myself and Deb Stott, who's the program manager for the Invitational. So it's quite the feat that we're trying to put out there, but I think we're going to put on a really good show and we're excited to talk about it today and really accentuate how well the Invitational is going to be run and what kind of dogs run in the Invitational.
Perfect. Angie, do you have any updates for us of the Invitational from the last time that we chatted?
Well, the dates again are Sunday, September 12th through September 18th, Saturday. So it's a week long. So there'll be a lot of people taking a week off to attend this test, to volunteer for this test. We have 236 dogs going this year. Now, that's a double test this year because last year of COVID, obviously, we had to shut down and we allowed those dogs that qualified to branch over to this year and run this year. So we're running with 236 dogs and about 50 volunteers each day to make this happen. So we're trying to make it extra special this year because everybody had a year off and we're trying to do new things. There's going to be more field sites going on because we're trying to run that many dogs through. But the most that we can run dogs through really with our volunteers and the space we have is 36 dogs a day. So that's why we had to extend it out for that full week. It took a lot of decision-making to get it to that point. We were hoping to do it within the 4 to 5 day range. There were so many options we were looking at, but we ended up, the committee recommended to the board of directors of NAVDA to run it for the full week and they approved it. And so that's what we're planning and moving forward. And really we're only about 5 months away or a little less than. So we're boots on the ground and we're running pretty quickly to get this show on the road.
How are you looking for volunteer numbers? Do you know? Are you guys still looking for more?
We're always looking for volunteers because you spread it out for so long. There's lots of jobs to do and there's not one job that's too little. In order to volunteer, if anybody is interested in volunteering, you think about it. This is our Super Bowl of the dog world. So generally, it's the top 100 to 125 dogs in a year that will run in the Invitational. And this year, obviously, it's a little bit bigger because we're doubled. But we really need the volunteers every single day. And you get a chance to see some of the top dogs in the country and pretty much in the nation. We have dogs running from Canada, from Hungary. So it's pretty cool that we're able to showcase this type of test. So people to volunteer and just, even if they get a chance to plant a bird or maybe, you know, help out in the, what do they call it? Help out in the tent where they sell t-shirts and stuff like that. Can really showcase and see, help out with our opening ceremonies. You know, we're going to be looking for people to sing the national anthem and the Canadian anthem. And, you know, there's not one job that isn't going to expose you to, you know, the top test running in the country at that time in September. So it really is a neat thing. And maybe it'll get you in your blood and you'll start drinking the Kool-Aid and people will get excited to start training for it.
Awesome. So Tracy, besides singing the national anthem, where else are we going to see you at the Invitational this year?
I actually have a hard decision to make every year because my daughter's into showing horses in 4-H. And this year is going to be a horse year for me. So I am taking a hiatus and I'm going to go to the state 4-H expo and support my daughter this year. So
aww,
maybe you'll
good
see
for
me next
you.
Year.
Yeah, good for you. Well, we'll put you on the national anthem for next year then.
Yeah, right.
How about you, Angie? Where are you going to be at besides running the whole show this year? Are you judging? Are you running dogs?
Yeah, so Sunday I'm running a dog. My husband's running a dog on Sunday. We have a puppy buyer that's running a dog on Monday, so I am off on Monday. And then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, I will be judging. I'll be 4 days in the field and 1 day at the water. Awesome. And I'm excited this year. For the first time, I'll be able to, on Thursday, be the senior judge in the field. So I'm pretty excited about that because it takes, you know, for your peers to believe that you have that capability to do that. It's an honor. So I'm excited to do that and really, you know, help handlers through this most important test. And, you know, all have been there. I'm going to be there on Sunday. I'm testing my own dog. You know, I have my own Zoe dog that'll be there. So I'll be know what it's like to be in every single handler's shoes when once I'm judging there Tuesday through Saturday. So I'm super excited about it. And then I'm always on call to help answer any questions or put out any fires that might happen. But pretty much Deb Stott will be doing that. We'll be communicating pretty much on a regular basis throughout that week.
Sounds good. Well, let's kick it off with the invitational stuff for this year. Well, actually, we have stuff that covers it for every invitational. But let's talk about eligibility. Besides being a NAVDA international member, what else does it take to make it to the invitational?
Well, basically, you have to run a utility test and you have to receive a prize one. You have to be within good standing with NAVDA. Just like you said, Courtney, you have to be a NAVDA member. So you need a utility prize one score to be invited to the invitational in order to run the following year. So, for example, if you run a dog this year and you receive a utility one prize score, you'll be able to be invited to the invitational for 2022 in New Mexico.
There was a rumor at one time that that might change from being just a prize one to being a 204 in order to go to the invitational. Has there been any talk about that? Was that just a bad rumor?
It was a consideration before we figured out how to handle. The problem with this whole NAVDA testing scenario in any NAVDA test is that we were just chatting before we started. In 1992, when I showed up at a test, a third of the dogs would pass. Invitational, the first invitational, I think only a third of the dogs would pass each day. So the dogs are getting better. The training is getting better. The handlers are getting better. The system is working. And for a while there, NAVDA didn't know how to keep up with it. And so they were trying to come up with ways to limit the dogs so that everybody doesn't feeling overworked. The invitational used to be where you had 2 years to prepare for it, because it used to be every other year the invitational would run. And so you would get a prize one with your dog. If you got a prize one, you had 2 years to prepare for the invitational. And then they made it go every year. So then your preparation time was a little bit shorter, but it worked because, like I said, breeders are breeding better dogs. NAVDA's the only dog club that I know in the United States and in Canada where we all get together and help each other train our dogs. I don't know of any other dog club that does that. That's a hunting dog club. And the system is working. And for a while there, they didn't really know how to handle it. And I think they've got a pretty good handle on it now. And I'm not sure. Maybe Angie can talk a little bit about it. I'm not sure that that's really a problem anymore.
Okay.
No, it's not. It's as long as I've been involved with the invitational, even before I was a judge, I was the test secretary and I assisted the test secretary role. That has not been a consideration. So I would say probably for the last 8 years, it's been a utility prize. One dog has been invited to the invitational for the following year.
Got it. What percentage currently go from that utility prize one to the invitational?
Yeah, an example would be, so in 2019, we had 200 dogs utility prize one. And in 2020, we had 184 dogs prize one, which is pretty cool for a pandemic year, for when NAVDA really didn't start out their testing season until July 1 last year. We had 184 dogs get a utility prize one. So it's pretty miraculous. If you add up those 2 years and you figure it out, and we've got 236 dogs running this year, on average, you're anywhere between 45 to 55% of the dogs that get a prize one decide to go to the NAVDA Invitational. And they have to make that decision, because if they want to go any other year, they all have to requalify their dog. So if you qualify your dog this year and you decide, oh, I don't want to drive all the way to New Mexico, well, if you don't want to run,
You have to requalify your dog then in 2022 to go to Ohio for 2023.
So why would somebody want to run the Invitational? Why are we striving for that? What exactly does that test prove that will make a better bird dog?
Just to go through the different levels, natural ability dog has all the natural inherited traits you need to that the breeder has put into the dog. Utility dog shows all of the tools required to be a biddable dog that you can train and go forward with, and it will take the pressures of training, remember what it's taught, and work for the handler. An invitational dog, and maybe Angie will tell me I'm wrong, an invitational dog is one that you can show off, and one that it's a higher level obedience in the invitational test, and it's a little bit more pressure and a little bit more training. And I think it's a dog that has to show strong, strong cooperation and the want to please, or you're just not going to make it go get through the invitational.
Absolutely. And you get that even training for the invitational if you don't pass it. You know, myself, the year that I didn't pass the invitational, I took a friend hunting and they saw my Brandy dog, all that she could do. And they were pretty amazed at her obedience, how I could heal from one cattail slew to the other, you know, and there's birds everywhere and their dog's running ahead. Well, the invitational test prepares you for that. And Tracy's right. It is a chance for you to really show off the qualities of your dog, your breeding program, your training, and even, you know, how much your chapter helped you. It takes a village to get an invitational dog even there. So the fact that you're there and you're testing really showcases these top-notch dogs. And I'll say it again, this is our Super Bowl of the dog events in the NAVDA world.
And would you guys agree that this test is just so much based around that cooperative dog, the very obedient dog? And if you're going to focus on anything in training right now, make it that obedience. Heal your dog everywhere you're taking them.
The biggest thing that I see with the invitational dogs, and I can tell you this from experience because I did it to myself and said, oh, for the next years, the first time we ran it, the first time we ran it was in 96. And so all the quite strict healing wasn't quite in place yet. But throughout the years and how much it's changed, get your dogs used to healing not only to things, but away from things. Because if your dog brings you back a retrieve at the water, and you happy dance and walk away. And sometimes if the dog's used to just strolling away and going to go to the bathroom on something or stroll away and just do its own thing, and it's not used to healing away from that each task, that makes a big difference between training and testing.
General information about the invitational. So Bitches in Season, you know, in a lot of different venues, Bitches in Season aren't able to participate. Can you guys touch on that for the invitational? Because they are allowed, but what is the course of action that's happening every morning?
Yeah, the Bitches in Season are allowed to participate, but there is a morning bitch check-in. So when you check in, if you have a female dog, you'll be asked to bring your dog up to the table, and a judge will be checking your dog to make sure they're not in heat. Even spayed dogs we check, It may seem weird, but it's also for the perception that we're checking all dogs. Very rare, but every once in a while, there's one or two dogs that each day are spayed and their handlers are there. And they're like, well, my dog's, you know, spayed. It doesn't matter. It's the perception that all female dogs are checked. And if your dog does show to be in heat, we'll ask them to run the very last day, which is Saturday, September 18th. So if you're going to show up on Sunday, September 12th, You better make sure your dog is not in season, because you will be going to the very last day. All bitches in season will run the last day of the test. If you know ahead of time your dog is in season, we ask that you contact the test secretary, Deb Stott. That way she can adjust the day's running orders right away. Because I know we'll get into this a little later, but, you know, Deb picks brace mates the night before. And so we want to make sure we have your correct day that you're running prior to you getting there. And sometimes things happen, but, you know, when you bring your female up and if you know she's in heat and you still try to get by with it, you're probably not going to get by with it, because we will see it. And then it actually, it causes more work for us, to be honest with you. If you have any inkling she's in heat, we ask that you just let us know so we can put you at the end of the day, and then you'll still get to run. You will go last. You're going to go last in the water. We try to put all the bitches in season in the same field area so that there's no males around. But you will go last in all the events in the water for sure.
What about training and running on the test ground? So beforehand, right now, like people that may live in or around Iowa, you want to give your dog that image of the water. Are they able to make that trip to Iowa and put them across that water right now? Or what are your dates and rules for that?
Angie may be able to clue you in a little bit farther, closer to that. I usually don't go out to the grounds and train just because I know I can't, but I'm not sure exactly how far before the test that is. I think it's 6 months. I might be wrong.
Yeah, no, you can't. You cannot train your dog on the invitational grounds at all as of when the entries close. So this year we closed the entries on March 1st. After that point, you cannot run your dog on those grounds. It's supposed to be virgin grounds when you get there. We don't want some handlers to have advantages over the other. So basically base it off if your entry is due March 1st or if it's due April 1st, the very last day after that date, you are not allowed to test or train on the test grounds until after the test.
Okay. What about that weekend or that week when we're showing up for the invitational? Is there separate training grounds for us to be able to practice on?
Yeah, there is a practice field and there's also a bitches field. So if your female is in season and you get there and we do that bitch check and you have to wait around for a couple days, there is a specific field for you to run your dog if she's in season. And then there is a separate field that you may train your dog on that is not used in the test at all. But you will not be able to test on any of the water unless you find your own water. But the invitational committee and the chapter hosting the test will provide grounds for you to air out your dog and practice with your dog if you so choose to. But again, there is no water practice once you get there unless you find it yourself outside the grounds.
I know in Ohio, there's a lot of little pieces of water that I was able to find to go do maybe 20, 30 yard blinds on just to get the dog acclimated to being someplace else and doing a blind in a new place. I know the one practice field, maybe I just got lucky and there was a pond in it and I did a few blinds on that and a few double marks on that when I got there.
What about the professional photographers? So this is going to be something new at the invitational level because you have photographers. I think they're at every field every day, aren't they?
Yeah, there's professional photographers every day. You have that option. The photographer will ask you if it's okay for them to walk in the field with you. And you have that opportunity to say no. And everybody has to agree to it. So you are out there with a brace mate. So you and your brace mate both have to agree to have that photographer out there. If either one of you say no, the photographer will not go out there. And then at the end, that photographer, way after the invitational is done, it'll be posted in the magazine and online where you can go check out those photos that the photographer might have taken of you that day. And they'll tell you their name. I mean, you have that opportunity to download those photos and purchase them from that specific photographer. You cannot bring your own professional photographer out there. It is supplied by NAVDA.
What should a handler be bringing to this test? What do we all need besides water? Because it is September in Iowa. It is usually hot from what I remember in my experience. So besides water, 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 what else should we be bringing to this test?
I know I always pack some sort of electrolytes for the dogs. Dogs cannot absorb the electrolytes that we ingest. Their systems are different. So whether that be a energy bar made for dogs or something to put in their water, it's good to acclimate them to that, though, before you go. You never should introduce anything new to eat or drink at that level on like day of testing or when you're training there, So I would recommend if you're going to take something, start that about maybe 2-3 months before so that the dog system gets acclimated to having those things. When I'm running the Invitational, I bring lots of water bottles and I always use all of my water. I literally water the dog every 5 minutes or after every bird. So that's a lot of water bottles throughout the field. And what I may do, just my own thing that I've done handling. For instance, I use it's called Rehydrate. You put it in your water. For the first half of the search, I use regular water. For the second half, I use the Rehydrate. It's just what's worked best for me. A fan to put on your dog's crate. Do not ever recommend putting the dog when it's hot in air conditioning. You're going to shock him and send him the other way. Going to give him hypothermia. They do make cooling mats for crates if your dog doesn't chew, but I know most of our dogs like to destroy everything that they lay on. It's like a ice pack, but it's got like little cells in it and you can freeze it. Some people like to use the cooling rags that you wrap around the dogs and put over their back. Those are good after they're done to cool them off. I don't know, whatever training equipment you're going to need. I've already brought release straps with me 1 year because I was having problems with stop to flush like 3 days before the test. So that was fun. I don't know, whatever training equipment you need, I guess dead birds. If you're going to just do some dead bird retrieves or some marks, things like that, just trying to think of what I normally would bring. I don't know. I can't think of too much else, I guess.
What about Blaze Orange, a break open shotgun?
Yeah. In the test, you can use your own in the field or you can use one supplied by the chapter or by the international, in the water for the double mark, you use the gun that's supplied because it is a double barreled gun and it is designed to shoot both the poppers, some of the selectors and some of the either side by sides or over and unders won't, the selector won't switch over when you're shooting the blank loads, so they make sure ahead of time that these guns will select over, so you're better off. You have to use the gun that's supplied by the chapter. I bring my e-collar with me. Sometimes I don't need it, but what if I do and I'm out there running the dog and it finds a deer or it finds something that it wants to chase? I have the means to stop it.
Yeah, the only thing I was going to add is, you know, the orange, and make sure you bring stuff for yourself as well. Water, you know, Gatorade, whatever the case may be, because, you know, like me, I get pretty, once I'm out in that field, you're out in the field for an hour, I get thirsty myself. Now I do drink just the dog's water. So just make sure whatever you're drinking is something that, that you can drink as well.
You have Rehydrate in it?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if you want that or not. I haven't tried it yet, Tracy, but we'll see.
All right. Let's start out what a typical day of the Invitational looks like. So we are waking up bright and early with nerves all over our bodies, ready to vomit because we're nervous as heck.
Well, what is a typical day? Well, the big thing is people are going to be instructed to be at the grounds by 6:30 so they can find out their running orders, because running orders are picked the night before. So you don't know what area you're running in, where you're starting out first, who your brace mate is in the field till that morning of. So we ask handlers to be there at 6:30 to check in. They'll find out their running order. Because it is such a big test and we're running 36 dogs in 1 day, we're going to be splitting dogs up. So some dogs will start their day out in the field. Some dogs will start at the double mark and some will start out at the blind. And that's all laid out pretty well in the running order. Once you pick it up at 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, we have meet the judges and an opening ceremonies. To me, it's a very surreal event because you've worked really hard to get there. And so once you get there and you're there and you realize that this is the day that you are going to showcase your dog, that's when I get the most nervous. I've seen this test bring grown men and women and professional trainers to their knees. It is, you put so much heart and work into it. And I think for me personally, that opening ceremonies just brings it all together. Like, okay, this is real. It's go time. And it's really time to focus. So opening ceremonies is going to last probably about 10 to 15 minutes. And our goal is to get started then either in the field or the water sites by 7:30, 7:45, just depending where you're heading to.
And you have the option to bring your dog to that opening ceremony or not, right? So they give you the medallion and a sign. Do you guys personally opt to bring your dog out, or do you prefer to keep them in the vehicle?
Well, for me, I'll back up. You're right. There's placards up there, and each handler gets a handler bag with some goodies in it that's donated by some of the sponsors. Then generally a medallion is handed to each handler, whether you pass or fail. This year, it's probably going to be done a little bit different because of COVID rules. And then the judges would go by and shake each handler's hand. We're just going to probably do it a little bit different format. The handlers will get to meet the judges. They just won't be shaking, you know, all the judges' hands. There's, I believe, what, 15 judges, and you're going to see who your bracemate is because you'll probably be standing next to them when you're getting ready. So
depends on where I'm starting. The one that I had to start at the double mark, I left my dog in the truck because healing was not his best thing. So I didn't want to get him all excited. If I'm starting in the field and I have a few braces before me, then I'll probably bring my dog up because I like to bring him up and showcase him, let people see him.
Yeah, I have not. My husband and I both have ran this test and we have not brought our dogs up. I'm simply trying to just keep them calm and in their crate. And, you know, they're already amped up because they could probably feel my heart racing 110 miles an hour. So, you know, that opening ceremonies and with the music and different dogs around and people, I just choose to keep them in the crate, but that's my personal decision. But like Tracy, she likes to do it. And there's a lot of handlers that do. And it's a great photo op as well. Our professional photographers are there for opening ceremonies. And if you have your dog there, we'll take a picture of you generally. So again, it's a personal decision.
So everybody gets the sheet that tells them where to go. So it's going to vary for everybody, but for the sake of, let's just choose something to start with here. Let's go with the field first. What is going to be the expectations in that field portion? What are the dogs expected to do?
They have to hunt for an hour with another dog. Typically they'll keep you together long enough running with your brace mate so they can see some natural backing. If the other dog is naughty, or if your dog is naughty and taking birds out and not behaving, then they may separate you and then try to bring you back together later on in the brace, just to maybe let the other dog settle down and not affect your dog. Was unfortunately, dogs usually only teach them each other the bad things, never the good things. So when one dog's misbehaving, sometimes it's catchy. Your dog is expected to obviously be steady. It's expected to back. It's expected to be all retrieves to hand. If you have a wild flush, unlike the utility test, if you have a wild flush and the gunners are close enough, they will shoot it. Typically what I've seen, and maybe Angie can kind of talk about a little bit about this too, but typically in my experience running a dog, usually they're too far away to shoot the wild flushes, but sometimes they do get close enough. So that's something that you need to prepare your dog for, because when that dog is not used to seeing those wild flushes fall out of the sky, it can be a different experience for them. And usually when one dog breaks, the other dog breaks. So they usually have water out there. So for your dogs, water tubs and water buckets. It seems that when these dogs are running the field, if it's really hot out, right about the half hour mark, it seems the dog is struggling and you're struggling to keep up and you're wondering how the heck you're going to make it through this hour. And then they seem to find their stride. And they just kind of level out and they just kind of glide through. I know as a judge, when I judge it, all of us are pretty good at letting the dogs at each water break catch their breath. We're never in a hurry to leave the water buckets. We give plenty of time for both handlers' dogs to be in there one at a time. Nobody's in a hurry. No matter how fast you walk, no matter how slow you walk, you're going to be out there for an hour. there's plenty of birds to find and there's plenty of judging opportunities. So I find that we take our time at the water and we let the dogs catch their breaths and we try to keep them in the shade when they're in the water.
Yeah, it's going to be the exact same when you're getting ready for a utility test, except for you now have somebody with you. You're running a brace mate. You're going to have a gun with you. You're going to have gunners that you're going to have to direction in the field. And you have to be mindful of your brace mate. So if your dog goes on point, you want to remember that you have a brace mate out there that's coming in to back you. And so your dog might have to stand there for a little bit of time for them to bring in the other dog for that back. Once that dog is either backed or the judge will say, just play out the bird, we'll have the gunners will be on each side of you exactly like the utility test, and you'll be expected to swing on your bird as well. So that's something to remember is, you know, you're going to be reminded, people will get nervous, but don't forget to swing on your bird. And one thing I would like to say is when you release your dog for that retrieve, be again mindful of your brace mate. You're going to have another dog back there. So if you say fetch really loud, that other dog has the potential of breaking. You want to release your dog either, I release them by their name or a head tap. So you'll have to decide the best way to release your dog, but please be very mindful of your brace mate when you're out there. You guys are a team, you're hunting together. And that's something that people aren't used to because we don't test that in any other part of the NAVDA system but the invitational. So having a different dog out there, running with two dogs, just to, again, be very mindful how you're working your birds when it comes that time. And then your dog might be the other one where it's coming in for the back. And you want to make sure that your dog establishes that back on their own. No commands. We just want to see that dog hit that back without any influence from you. So you're going to be instructed by the judges to keep moving. They don't want you standing still. So once the pointing dog goes on point and that backing dog, say it's your dog, is coming in, the judge is going to ask you to keep moving because they want to see that dog establish the back on its own. And then you have to stand away from your dog. You're not very close to them. You're standing back a little way so you're not influencing the dog. And then it goes to steadiness, and your dog has to be steady through the entire bird sequence of the pointing dog. So once that dog points the bird is shot and brought to hand. Then the judges will instruct you when it's time to go to your dog, and then you heal them away and start hunting again. So there's a lot to think about when you're out there as well. But always ask the judges questions. That's why they're out there. You're going to have a handling judge that's going to be with you the entire time. So even if you do have to break away, like Tracy said, because maybe the judges have seen everything they want to see, or maybe because the dogs are being naughty, you're always going to have a gunner with you, and you're always going to have a judge with you. So ask that judge questions. They're going to help guide you through the field. Every part of that test, just like any NAVDA test, the judge is there to help you see the very best that they can out of your dog. And especially at this high of a stakes game, they know people are nervous. They know they forget to swing on their birds, but they're going to remind you. So just keep that in mind as you're out there in the field, is the judge is your friend out there.
I'd just like to point out, too, because a lot of people that run, prepare their dogs for the Invitational also will run the AKC hunt test to run with a different dog, run on different grounds, run with underneath some judges and put themselves in the judging aspect of things, because it makes your temperament a little bit different when you're running your dog and training and when you're testing. I'd just like to point out that the backing is different from AKC to the Invitational. So if you look at the steadiness sequence in AKC, backing is backing from the point to the start to back until your dog is released after the retrieve. In AKC, that's all backing. And the Invitational, if you look at the different steadiness sequences, there's pointing for the there's pointing, steady to flush, steady to wing, steady to shot, and steady to fall. So in the backing dog, your back takes the place of that pointing scenario in that steadiness sequence. And then as soon as the backing dog is aware that the handler is there, now steadiness takes over. So it's a little bit different than AKC.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that out too. And I think, I mean, I know both of you actually run your dogs through Master Hunter, similar as we do with our dogs before the Invitational, just to kind of keep them keen and giving them that extra experience, but also the importance of your dog seeing different breeds out there helps, you know, if even if you're not doing AKC tests, find, if you have a short hair, wire hair, Vizsla, find dogs with tails, find dogs that point with different styles. Some dogs go on point that might not necessarily look like they're on point. So get your dog used to that view.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many different dogs because you're not going to know what dog you're running with. So before I go to the Invitational, I'm going to try to, you know, train with a Vizsla, a Brittany, a wire hair, a Wyme, any dog that I know that's going to be running that day, have an opportunity for my dog to back them, because it is interesting that some of the dogs respect some and some don't respect others. You know, I've seen dogs, totally my own dogs, respect each other, respect other dogs. And then there might be a Brittany or an English setter they haven't seen before. And they're like, no, I don't respect you. And I'm just either going to steal your point or just not back you. And that's something you need to train for and get ready for, because dogs need to be exposed to different things. Just because I have grounds right outside my door here, I have a full summer planned of traveling to get to different fields, to get to different water, because they get used to their environment and they get a little persnickety about where they're at. And just because they did it well at your house or at your home training grounds doesn't mean they're going to do it well elsewhere. And get used to traveling with your dogs so they know what it's like to go to a different location, and all of a sudden, whoa, I got to back a Brittany, or, oh, I got to back another short hair that doesn't look like me. So exposure is the key for that as well.
Right.
That was a good learning point for us. The second Invitational we ever went to, my dog ran with a dog with not much drive, and she sight pointed every bird, the brace mate did. And the only bird she would go on point, and there was never a bird there. So the only bird, I shouldn't say she sight pointed every bird. She would point and there would be no bird there. And my dog started back. Well, I wasn't running it. Al was running it. And she would start out backing, and that was not her strongest point. She was kind of greedy. And by the end, the only bird it pointed, it sight pointed on the road. And my dog decided that she couldn't stand it no more and took the bird out.
Yeah,
we didn't pass, but she decided she didn't want to back that dog anymore. And so that gave us a good insight in. At first, you will give your dog success every single time. Run it with a steady dog. Run it with another dog that backs. Run it with another dog that's respectful. And when the dog is doing well at that, Angie's exactly right. You need to run that dog with a dog that doesn't back. You need to run it with a puppy that's going to take out some birds on your dog when it's on point. You don't know. Things can blow up, and their animals are going to do what they do, and sometimes what they do is not what we want them to do. they don't want to do the jobs anymore because they're sick of doing them. So you need to prepare. The more preparation you can do for your dog in those respects, you know, the better.
Yeah. And I think also in preparation tips, I think something that's often overlooked is conditioning our dogs in the heat, because that September heat in Iowa is pretty brutal. And what I do appreciate in how the field portion is run at the Invitational, I feel like the judges try to actively keep the handlers and the dogs together at the beginning to get those backing situations going right away, so that you can split off later. Because if you're trying to get backs in those last 10 minutes of that 60-minute brace, you have dogs that are pretty hot, tired, and usually at that point, perhaps a little less likely to want to back. So it's kind of like, this is your chance.
Yeah. And the judges, again, they're there to help you. And you're right, Courtney. They're there right away to get, you know, you into the scenarios. And it might not always work that way either. The very first time I ran the Invitational in 2012, I was with my brace mate the entire time. And I was 45 minutes in and did not have a single bird contact. I was getting so nervous. My heart was racing. It was a windy day.
the dog was false pointing.
Oh, I remember that was in Ohio, wasn't it?
No, that was in Iowa.
Oh, that was that year in Iowa. Good golly. Yeah. To say that it was windy is an understatement.
Yeah.
That was really tough conditions.
You know, and the judges did an awesome job making sure that I got into a bird. And they did whatever they possibly could. You know, my dog already had a back by then, but, you know, I was concerned she was going to get, you know, ding in nose because she had so many non-productives. And my handling judge at the time said, look at the wind. They knew that there was a bird there. There was feathers there. The judges know where the birds are in general. So, I mean, I was all nervous about it. And to pass the invitational with one bird contact, my Izzy dog had one opportunity 45 minutes in. So you got to be prepared for anything. And that just leads to more training information. You know, I train in the rain and I do it later. Like Tracy said, put them in right now when I'm training. I was supposed to be doing blinds today, but it's windy right now and it's raining where I'm at. That wasn't going to set them up for success. But guess what? If it was just like this a week before the invitational, I'm going to train with them. So you want to set up if it's raining, if it's windy, you know, and that was something I wasn't quite prepared for. And I don't know if the judges, you know, they were just so seasoned and knew exactly what to do to make sure that it worked out for me. And it did work out in my favor because my dog passed that year. And that was the very first invitational I passed. So I had a good experiences and the judges really helped me through that. But anything can happen, you know, and you go back to your first question, what's a typical day? There's no typical day because, you know, all of a sudden there could be fog and you're delayed and you're not running for 2 hours till that fog comes off, or it's thundering or lightning, you're delayed, you know, and there is a very strong possibility that if the rain is too bad, that they would cancel the test for the day and move it to another rain delay day. So that's all stuff you have to be prepared for. You get to this level of testing, you'll get to test your dog, but you got to be able to roll with the punches as well.
Talking about rain and wet birds, I don't know if a lot of people realize this or not. Over the years of training, I've come to realize that when you're hunting wild birds, even in the rain, wild birds don't usually get wet because if they get wet, they die. So you're hunting dry birds all the time. And when these birds get wet, I think our dogs think they smell like a wounded bird and they scoop them up. I ran a utility test one time. It was me and Ron Bain. I had two utility dogs. He had one. And I know this is a little off topic, but just talking about wet birds, they had, I don't know what the mix is because I can't remember, but they had all naturability and our three utility dogs. And at that time, it was still under the belief that the utility dogs should run last. You know how many wet chuckers were out there? It was awful. And my dog scooped every wet chucker and she pointed and was completely steady on every dry bird they just put out for me. So it's important that you do train in the rain and get these birds wet and make them know that, nope, even though it smells like a wounded bird, you still have to point it.
Yeah, and a good way to do that is if you have a dry year, I actually take birds and wet them. I dunk them in a 5-gallon pail.
Yeah.
Or if it's really dewy one morning, we'll go plant birds just before sunup and let the birds' feathers get really wet and then go out and work the dogs in the morning dew. Because again, you are going to run into that. You could run into dew and you could be that first brace that goes out and those birds are going to get wet. So that's another thing to prepare for.
The judges will ask you to naturally flush the bird on the first attempt. So even when those birds are wet and you know they're not going to fly, try to kick them out, let them run around for a little bit, because that's exactly what's going to happen in the test. And you're going to have to catch that bird and throw it up in the air.
Let's talk about a couple more field scenarios to help people out. And Angie, you mentioned earlier to plan for your dog to be on point for a while. I mean, that could be maybe a 5-minute point if you're waiting for the other dog to come over and back. Or what happens if both dogs are on point? One dog is going to have their bird worked first, or do you have the gunner separate and each are worked at the same time?
You're each walking with the gunner. So if you're separated and both dogs find a bird, you should have a gunner walking right with you.
Again, like Tracy said, if you've got two dogs on point at the same time, the judges are going to talk, but your dog is going to have to hold point till the other dog works through its bird. So that's a situation that you could run into. So just be prepared for that.
And if your dog's on point and the other dog needs a back, within reason, the dog or the judge is going to make you stand there and move around. They don't want you influencing the dog. So if your dog is on point, you're going to have to keep walking around and your dog has to hold that point. And it could be for a few minutes. And again, it's going to be within reason. And the judges will make that decision. And if that dog's coming in and either not acknowledging the back or blowing off the back completely, which is pretty much the same thing, not acknowledging or blowing off, or it's just taking a long time to get them in the area, they're going to let you work that bird and then try to set it up again so that you get an opportunity for the other dog to back. So they give every opportunity for dogs to point and back each other.
The location in Iowa is a game farm. So from our experience of running that location a couple times with several different dogs, there are pheasant there and quail. And expect coveys. When chucker being the main bird that is being put out. But I think, you know, this year the scenario of more days, more birds being put out there, the likeliness to get into coveys of chucker is probably pretty high. And on that rule of if it flies, it dies, I know that they have, like, the gunners are shooting doubles out there. So prepare your dog to have that retrieve of the first bird, come back and go back out and retrieve that second bird.
We try at all costs as judges not to have them shoot two birds, but sometimes the gunners are watching the birds get up and they're not sure who's shooting. And so sometimes they do take one. And I know and Angie can kind of say what she thinks too. I know as a judge, I will give you a little bit. If two birds are down, we'll help you out on that second retrieve just a little bit. And we're not quite as strict on having that dog find it on its own.
Okay.
Yeah. And there's a lot there that you just said. So, I know that there's a misconception with this test being, you know, 7 days long that it is, or the 6 days that it is, that there's going to be a lot of birds out there. And yes, there will be, but also the chapter is doing everything they can to each night clean out the field. There's actually going to be a volunteer assigned to try to clean out the field. They're going to try to do it in the morning as well. There's certain states that have certain rules. In Ohio, they didn't allow you to clean out the fields, to my knowledge, whereas in Iowa, they're able to clean out the fields. Now, if your dog does come in contact with a rooster pheasant, the gunners will not shoot it because it's not within season. But be prepared. Your dog still has to be steady through the entire sequence. So if it points it, you don't want
it shoot flushing. In the air, right?
Yep, there'll be a shot in the air. So, but they can't shoot it. And it'd be the same. I think quail they would shoot, correct? They could shoot quail?
I don't know, because they're out of season. It's not birds that they put out.
Correct. So, yeah.
I think those would have to be a shot in the air also.
Yep. So the only bird that they would be shooting then is the chucker. But your dog still has to handle those pheasants and those quail all the way through the shot in the air. So it's still steadiness for them, and it's still a bird contact and a point and such, or a wild flush. You know, if a pheasant flies in the air, they got to stop. We don't want to see a chase. So that's something to take in consideration. Again, I know there is a rumor out there. I've heard it quite a bit that, you know, nobody wanted to run the last days of the test because they're afraid of so many birds out there. There's going to be residual birds, but again, there's a lot of people that are going to be working really hard to try to get those birds out the best they can and throughout the day. So once the test is over, they'll clean the fields. They'll come back an hour or two later, try to clean the fields, and then that morning of try to clean the fields prior to the judges putting out the birds. So I think it won't be as bad as what people are thinking.
Yeah, good to know. I didn't realize that. Great information. Was there anything else that you guys wanted to add in the field portion?
I don't think so. You know, you are expected to heel off leash into the field and be under control. And I guess we could probably talk about that when we talk about the heeling section of the test. It does not go under not judged under heeling. It's judged under cooperation and obedience, but we can go more into that when we talk about some of the water stuff, because there's a bunch of healing down by the blind retrieve and the honor. That's the same expectation as healing into the field.
Okay. Let's touch a bit on the pointing in the field portion, because that is one of the three areas that need to be a four. Personally, having had a dog that filled the invitational just based on that pointing score, what?
Me too.
Are you raising your hand?
I am. Me too.
Yeah, it sucks. It sucks. But I think it's something important that we need to touch on here, because it is probably the saddest result when you hear those scores being read off and you're just like gutted for that person. When they have fours everywhere else, and then that pointing was bloop. So the intensity, you know, the convincing point, like how is that point judged, and how can we kind of give some tips to help people realize how important that visual needs to be?
Well, there's two, there's two things with pointing. My dog failed because she does not like pen-raised birds, and she crouches, and so it looks like she's sitting. But she had so much intensity that the backing dog backed her every time. But it looked like she was sitting because she was in the crouch position, so you could kind of see that as a sit. So she was intense, but she just wasn't up in a pointing stance. And so that's why we got a three in pointing and failed the invitational. And there's also the loose point. You have to keep in mind when you're putting a bunch of pressure on these dogs that – the more pressure you can put on them on pigeons, the better. Some dogs can handle pressure on pen-raised birds and some cannot. So sometimes if you can substitute some of those birds when you're first teaching, so that most of your pressure goes on pigeons, because if they have a soft point or a sitting point on, because they don't want to do the work on a pigeon, who cares? We never use them in testing and we never hunt them. So if I can, and some dogs won't let you. Some dogs don't, they smell a pigeon and it's not gamey enough for them to recognize it as a game bird. And they just don't react the same. So that's what I try to do with my dogs when I'm putting pressure on them on game. But if you put too much pressure on your dog, that's where Angie can maybe see it a different way and maybe, you know, put some a little more light on it. But that's where I see the pointing start to get soft, is when they put a bunch of pressure on the dog on game birds. I just actually judged with a fellow that runs dogs that are known can be somewhat soft on point. And he had a dog that he passed at the Invitational a few years ago, and he could see his dog was starting to get softer on point, and he knew the pressure was kind of getting to her. I don't like to do this, because I think if you train the dog every day, at least a little something each day, it gets used to doing things. He gave the dog, he trained it every day, but he gave the dog like, I don't know how many weeks, I can't remember. I think he rested it on birds for like 4 or 5 weeks before the test. So the next bird it saw was on test day. And he said he created another problem, because the dog was on the edge of breaking, but he got his nice, good, hard points because it had the absence of those birds and was excited to see them again. So it just depends on how you think you can, if you can keep all those plates spinning and, you know, in the test, get put your fingers in all the holes, you know?
Yeah. We want to see that dog be, you know, convincing and standing in their back end, not moving. A little flutter of the tail is okay, but if the dog is standing the birds and they're moving their head around and maybe looking left or right, and it's really questioning if it's a point, I've seen it where that's where some of the threes have come up when I've been judging the invitational is, well, we know there's a bird there, kind of, but the dog's just standing there. And like Tracy said, a lot of it can lead to the pressure, but, you know, watch the head on the dogs. Is it moving around? Is its butt moving? A little tail waggle or a little flutter for me is okay. But that head, you know, generally shouldn't be moving.
Head and shoulders. Yep.
Yeah. Head and shoulders.
Yeah, if the judge has to ask you if they're on point, you're probably in trouble.
You don't want to be asked that. So is there a written rule or is it an unwritten rule? I thought I had heard something about They're not judged from the shoulders back.
Well, they are. Because if the back hips are moving, I don't like that either. But if the tail is moving and the shoulder and the head are pointing at the bird still, then, and it's not, when you walk up on the dog and the dog looks back at the handler and then looks back down at the bird, that's not the head movement we're talking about. Sometimes when you're walking up, the head will be moving back and forth. And you can't really tell exactly where the bird is, if it has a bird, or if maybe the bird moved off. So sometimes that happens. But if the bird is right where we thought it was and the dog is a good distance, not a distance away where we thought it should know where the bird is, then we're going to be looking at that intensity.
Okay.
Yeah, intensity is huge. That staunch point. And I guess if you have any questions on it this day and age, I would say, talk to other judges, talk to other breeders, talk to other people that have ran the test. If you even slightly have a question on pointing on your dog, get another opinion, because somebody like Tracy or myself or even you guys, Courtney, could say, it doesn't look real convincing to me. Mm-hmm. So really make sure, again, going back to if we're questioning your dog's on point, that's not a good thing. And if you're questioning your dog is not on point, that is a good thing. And if you think your dog is, but you're not sure, get a second, a third, a fourth opinion. And especially with video these days, video it and ask somebody if you can send it to them and say, does my dog look like they're on point? Because you're going to know before you get there what you have to work on.
That's true too, about getting an opinion that somebody that has not trained with you or doesn't know your dog, because someone that trains with you might know how your dog points. And if it's usually not real intense and then it starts getting a little bit more intense, they could go, well, that's a really good dog. That's a really good point for your dog. When in all reality, it might not be a very intense point, maybe more intense than it has been in the past, but it might not be as intense as it needs to be.
Mm-hmm. And even at the utility level, even if that dog's point hasn't changed from utility to the invitational, I mean, I know several people where that may have been accepted and okay, that dog's point in the utility, it's not good enough at the invitational level. Would you agree?
No.
Okay.
The pointing in the invitational is exactly the same as it should be in utility.
Would have just slipped through.
There's no more emphasis put on pointing at the invitational as there is for utility. Do you agree with that, Angie?
Yeah, absolutely. It should be exactly the same. I mean, a loose point at another test, utility, should be noted as well. We're judging it exactly the same from utility to the invitational in the pointing.
I think I know exactly what you're talking about. And there was a lot of people upset because there was a lot of dogs, I think that was out in Ohio, if I remember right, a lot of dogs that weren't short hairs ran. And a lot of those dogs did get threes in pointing. And a lot of them thought that this test was set up, that your dog needs to point like a short hair. And that wasn't the case at all. I don't know how those dogs, what they did in their utility tests. And I don't know who their judges were for the utility test or how they, like you said, some of them may have slipped through. I don't know. But I think there was a few years that people were really easy and soft on pointing. And unfortunately, sometimes those things happen. You go through trends. But it should be in everything it says in the rule book. Convincing, unmistakable. They should know right where the bird is. They should be looking right at it.
Yeah. And in utility test, you need a four in pointing to get a prize one, and you need a four in pointing in the invitational to pass it. It's pretty standard across the system that way, in the scoring way of it.
All right. Let's move on to the double mark. This is where the healing is officially judged, right? Like, this is where you're really on the scoreboard for it.
This is the healing portion of the test.
Yep. Okay. All right. So Yeah. So give us the explanation of what happens here in the double mark then. What does that look like?
So they paint a line. You come up to the line, take your leash off, you put it on the ground, and you heel. It's 25 yards to the blind. You do your work. You do your double mark. Put the dog back at heel, and then you heel 25 yards out to the line. And then after you cross the line, you can put your leash on. You carry your shotgun in and out. So the thing that you need to prepare your dog for is that after those retrieves, it swam 20 yards. Well, so it swam 40 yards on one bird, 20 out and 20 back, and it swam 120 yards on the other bird, 60 out and 60 back, maybe more if the wind is blowing and it's a longer retrieve. But you have to get that dog used to, you come right back. If you're going to go to the bathroom, do it quickly, get back, shake off, return to heel, and we're heeling out. They give you a few seconds to collect the dog, and then you're going out.
So the double mark part of it, like Tracy said, a judge will meet you and you're not going to have a leash. You'll be doing this off leash. So you're going to have to heel your dog all the way to the blind off leash while you're holding a gun. Then you're going to set your dog up and they're going to launch the memory bird, we call it, about 50 yards off. Again, if it's windy, you know, it may be a little bit further. And there'll be a shot and you have to do the shooting. So you're shooting at these birds. So once the memory bird comes out, you're going to shoot and your dog has to be steady and be next to you. Then they're going to do what's called a wiper bird and a bird's going to come directly across your dog and it's not going to drop too far from your dog from the shore and you have to shoot at that wiper bird. You're going to go ahead then, your dog has to be steady. You send your dog out now for the wiper bird first. So remember, you're shooting twice. You're going to shoot at the memory bird and the wiper bird. You're sending your dog for that wiper bird. And I think we both have seen some dogs go right for that memory bird. And that's not a good thing. You want to get them on that wiper bird. And as they're going out to the wiper bird, there's a distraction shot and there's another shot that goes off. So then your dog has to come back with that wiper bird and you will have the duck in your hands and the judge will talk to you prior to and you have the opportunity to hang on to that duck to before you send your dog for the memory bird or you can hand that duck back to the judge. I usually just throw the duck behind me and the judge is right back there and grabs it and then you send your dog off for the memory bird. So there's really a lot going on there. Once your dog comes back for that memory bird, like Tracy says, they can shake a little bit and then you have to heel all the way back out to where you started. So there's a ton of obedience in this part of the test.
Yeah, I appreciate that you mentioned that part of what you do with the duck and that you have an option as somebody that had the dog run up after the duck was handed to the judge, the dog ran up the hill to follow that duck. Afterwards, you know, it's those little pieces that you don't think about and you aren't necessarily training for. You know, we were never handing a duck to somebody. She always thought it was going to stay right there. So,
yeah. And I do want to clarify just to make sure once I said this correctly is once that wiper bird goes out, you're shooting at that wiper bird. So again, memory bird, wiper bird, you shoot at that memory or that wiper bird. When the dog has the duck in its mouth and it's coming back is when a distraction shot's going to go off. So be prepared. There's three shots in there. So they're distracting that dog. And make sure that they're able to remember where that memory bird is. And there's a lot of people that have different philosophies of training for this. And there's a lot of people that just train specifically for that memory bird. And then they throw in that wiper bird later on in their training, later on in the summer. So there's a lot of stuff that's going on in there. And to keep it straight in your head and make sure you really cue off your judges and you understand how the test runs before you even step off and start healing your dog, because there is a lot going on and there's a lot that you have to do on top of controlling your dog.
Why is there a distraction shot? What is the purpose of that?
To make sure that it remembers the memory bird to distract the dog. make sure that it stays on task.
It's also stimulating too, like if there's a lot of shooting going on around you. So if you're actually duck hunting and there's somebody shooting at another pond, you know, or maybe your buddy next to you shoots, it, like Tracy said, it's that dog still has to know that even though all these shots are going on, that they still have to go out and get that memory bird because that's a task that they're going to have to do.
One of the things that you need to prepare your dog for the testing, and this will help you at the double mark and at the honor, is to get it used to hearing a duck come out of a winger, because it can be disturbing for them to hear that the first time at the test. It does make a distinctive sound, and the memory or the wiper bird, the your short bird, the second bird that's launched right before you send your dog, comes from off to one side of the dog, and usually the dog, in both cases, the dog cannot see the winger. They're hidden. They can't see the person loading it, and they can't see the winger. They're hidden. And so that noise basically comes from nowhere.
Spider.
And I know a lot of dogs, the first time we did the double mark, at the first invitational we had it at, a lot of the dogs were thrown off because the short bird, the second bird thrown, the wiper bird, came from almost behind the dog and came over their head. And they had a hard time following it and marking it because they heard the winger go off and they were so busy trying to figure out where the bird came that it landed out in front of them and they had no idea that it landed. There's also two pods of decoys out in the pond that the dogs have to swim through. So basically they have to swim through decoys to get to each fall. And also, depending on the wind, depending on the pond setup, your birds can be coming from left to right or right to left. They're no longer defining which way it's coming from, because if the wind varies, we have to change it at the test. So one day of testing, it could come from one way, and one day of testing, it could come from the other. It just depends on if that wind changes and it's not a good situation to send it the way it was the day before, it might have to change. They used to tell you which way it was coming from, depending on which grounds we were using. It does not anymore. So best suggestion would be practice both ways.
Good point.
Yeah,
Tracy.
And it's minimal handling of your dog, meaning you can't put your hands on your dog. So after you receive that first retrieve, without touching your dog, you have to position them for that memory bird. And it's very minimal handling to get them to that memory bird. So for me, once I have that bird in my hand from the wiper bird, I'll tell my dog to heel. I'll line them up with the memory bird and say fetch. And hopefully your training is in there and solid enough that they know to look across and that they've got to go get that memory bird. So throughout this whole test, you can't touch them and put them into position or anything like that. It's basically a lot of healing to get them into the position you need to line them up. Again, when I ran this for the very first time, the wind was so bad. I saw where that memory bird was. I actually moved down once I got the first bird or the wiper bird. I moved down probably 5 yards to my left and I heeled her there and lined her up and said, fetch. Because I saw how much the wind had drifted that bird and I was trying to get her on the best line that I possibly could. So again, minimal handling without putting your hands on the dog, but also adjust to the situations that are in front of you. It's a lot to think about.
Now, if you can see your memory bird and the dog is going offline and you need to handle your dog, like at the blind, some people teach their dogs handling like a lab. You can handle your dog a minimal of times out in the water too. You know, less is always better, but if it's going awry and you don't think you're going to pass the test, you're better off giving them a couple commands. But if you give them those commands, they have to listen to them. They have to be answered. They can't go unanswered.
And in the utility portion of the healing, we were used to seeing the stakes. So, and I don't think we mentioned it, but no healing stakes. Yep. So you're able to.
A little bad depending on the lay of the ground and the grounds that we're using.
Okay. And so we're able to set up our dogs where we want them to be then, like you touched on, Angie?
Well, they'll be in area as much as the shoreline that it's going to give you. Okay. You know, it depends where you're at in Ohio. You don't have much room to move around to set your dog up. But the particular pond that I used when I did it in 2012, I had a little extra shoreline to adjust. You have to be prepared for every situation. So at that point, I adjusted because I had the room to. But if I was at a different location, I wouldn't have had the room to adjust that.
Yeah, in Ohio, you wouldn't have been able to do that.
No. Again, you're not going to have a leash with you. There's no healing stakes, and that dog has to heal. I judged it one time. I think I was an apprentice they call it an alternate judge, before I was getting ready to be qualified to judge the Invitational. In order to judge the Invitational, you do have to be a senior judge, but you also have to apprentice the year before at the Invitational. I saw a dog, the guy said heal, and he ran all the way to the blind. And that was the end of that day for him. So
Steve had sometimes a judge will walk in front of you. Steve had a judge trip and fall down. His dog left heel and he was adjudged accordingly. So anything can happen. Dog's got to heal.
And is it in Iowa where there's a really steep drop off, like not too far off the bank there in the double mark? Yeah. Or is that Ohio?
That's Ohio.
That's Ohio. You go down into a dip and you come back out.
Yep. Okay.
Oh yeah. And down the road. Yeah. That was steep right there. Yep. So you just never know what you're going to have.
So situations when, like you said, when there is a windy day, if that duck is drifting all the way over to a bank and the dog decides on that retrieve, they're only a couple feet from the bank and running the bank back to you instead of taking that water back to you. What is the insight on a judge's point from that?
That's perfectly fine, but they have to swim out.
Okay.
They cannot run out. If they run along the bank and dip their front feet in and grab the duck and run back along the bank, that is not good. They have to swim. I'm not sure if there is a distance. Angie, is there a distance that they have to swim out? I mean, if they're swimming out and they get over to the bank and then they run down the bank, I think they have to get maybe past the short winger at least before they go to the bank. But they do have to swim out. But they
get it's completely swim out. Yeah, they completely have to swim out. And however they get back,
we prefer
they swim back. And I believe in Ohio, they don't really have a choice. They have to swim back. Right. But if you're doing it in a pond or a cattail slough like they have in Iowa, as long as the dog swims all the way back, and even if it is a windy day, and that happened to us, and it was an unfortunate event. She just kept getting hung up at that 50, 60 yard mark. She wasn't going any further because the wind had taken it all the way to the shore. I even tried to send her on a back like she was at a blind. And the judges were very cool and let me try to restart her for that memory bird. And that was the year that we failed in 2016. I'll never forget it. And you can believe me, I'm going to be training for it a lot differently this year. But really making sure that they can go beyond that 50, 60 yard mark. And that's why it's good. Once you've got the double mark down, go on a very windy day and practice that and see where your flaws are. But yes, the dog has to swim completely out. And however they come back, if they do have the opportunity to take the shore, as long as they come directly back to you, they don't go parading around. They don't go burying the duck. They don't go into the next county. They come directly to you. You should be okay.
Okay.
You have to get the short bird first too. You have to go
fail,
for the
right?
bird first, and then you have to go for the memory bird. You cannot send for the memory bird first.
Okay.
No, and dogs that go for the memory bird first, if you can call them off, you can get a three in the double mark and still pass. If you can call them off and get them back within a reasonable time, I mean, this is good handling. Get them back and get them to that memory bird. Because if you can't stop them, or I'm sorry, get them back and get them to that wiper bird. If you can't stop them and they go for that memory bird, and again, you can't stop them, you'll fail that part of the test because they have to bring that wiper bird back first.
Good tip, knowing when to use your commands. Yep. What about the dog that's running at the bank and kind of giving that little bit of avoidance or hesitation before they're going for that wiper bird or even the memory bird?
The wiper bird is so short and so close to the dog, unless they didn't see where it fell, I don't know. I've judged the double mark a couple of times and I've never seen a dog do that. Not to say they can't, but, you know, less commands are better, but sometimes you're better off asking for forgiveness and permission. You know, you have to get the dog to it. If it's not going out there, you might have to give another command.
Okay.
And yep. The judges will judge. But it just depends on how severe it is, how many commands, how much time passes that they're running up and down the shore, things like that.
Okay. Anything else you guys wanted to touch on in the double mark?
No, I think so.
Nope, this is pretty laid out pretty well, too, how we described it on the NABDA website. So I encourage handlers to go there and read about each section of the test. Everything we're describing here today, field and water sequences, are on the NABDA.org site, and where we talk about specifically in the invitational in each part of the test. So please educate yourself prior to getting there. I say it every time, work with trainers, work with your handlers, as far as handlers working with NABDA members, you know, talk to people that have done this before so you know what to expect.
Mm-hmm. I know a lot of the NABDA chapters we've been involved with, a lot of separate kind of groups break out through these seasons before the invitational and they start training together, because you're doing blinds, you're doing these double marks. It's nice just to have that set up and be able to go through that group of your chapter members all together. And yeah, and to have your dogs do that field portion to see other breeds.
Yeah, and it's very cool. There is a group here, the North Central chapter is trying to get all the invitational handlers together within, you know, a certain mileage range. So the Wisconsin River, the Wisconsin and Kettle Moraine chapter, anybody that's qualified a dog for the invitational, we're on a text messaging type string now. And so if anybody's doing blinds somewhere, they say, hey, we're doing blinds here. Here's the GPS coordinates, you know, come train with us. You know, we're setting up training days. Again, it takes a village to get there. And there's a lot of people that do it on their own, but for me, it's good for my dog to go all over and maybe go run some fields in Green Bay and then go run a blind over in, you know, North Central water. So get out there. It's going to take a lot of mileage and a lot of gas money, but I think that's what you need for the exposure for your dog. And we're going to be working with a lot of people.
Yeah. And learning the different techniques that people are using, because everybody does something a little bit different. So use what may work for you and your dog. All right. The blind retrieve. This is sometimes the easy one for people and sometimes the most feared. What are we looking for here? What are the expectations for this portion of the test?
Well, I would say you're going to meet your judge. Again, you're going to have a separate set of judges. So we should clarify that as to, in UPT, utility, natural ability, you have the judges throughout the day with you at the field and the water. You're going to have different judges at each section. So you'll have your field judges, you'll have your double mark judges, and you'll have your honor judges. So you'll be meeting a different set of judges. You're going to go up to the blind. And basically what the blind is simulating is a dead duck or a duck that you had shot and then had crawled up on land and died. So what you have to do is send your dog across is generally about 100 yards, a body of water, and they do not see a shot, or I'm sorry, they do not see the drop of a dead duck. They do not hear a shot. It's simply you bring them up to the line. They're looking across, and you need to send them all the way across that water. Most people use the word back. Some use fetch. I don't know what other commands maybe Tracy has heard, but generally it's a lot of backs, and that's how I train my dog. So they're going to be next to you, and you're going to want to line them up and say back, and they have to go completely across, find the duck that had crawled up on shore, and bring it all the way back to you. Now, the bird planner, what they are going to do is throw it in the water and lay a scent down for you and then drag it all the way up onto the island or the shoreline, wherever you're sending your dog across, so that there is a scent once your dog gets over there, and then bring it all the way back. And it's hard for some dogs to do that task. 100 yards is a long ways. It's a football field, if you really think about it. And that dog has got to trust you that there's something over there. And again, they don't see a bird fall out of the sky. They don't hear a shot. They're simply trusting that when you say back or fetch, that there's a bird on the other side and they have to bring it all the way back. And there's a lot of things that can happen in between from the time that you say back to the point where that bird actually gets back in your hand, that duck. And then you're going to have to, once you have that duck in your hand, you're going to have to heal out. And that part of the test is obedience, but you're going to have to heal over to the honor, which is another part of the test. But people need to be prepared and they need to practice this with their dogs as far as going across different waters, what it's like, what happens if your dog gets halfway out and they turn around on you. We call it a pop. You know, how to get your dog to keep going back and trusting you that there is a dead duck over there. I've done a ton of training for the honor right here in my driveway, doing line drills with back, teaching the dog. I'd heel her 50 yards out and I'd use my hand and I would say back, like a back motion. It's a retriever trick, I believe. To get them to understand that there's something farther way back there that they need to retrieve and bring it back to you. So you've got to be prepared for that. You got to be prepared if your dog gets across and maybe doesn't take quite a straight line and then goes into a duck search. How are you going to get them out of that? Is it a hope and a prayer, or have you trained them to go on a whistle command? And I'm sure Tracy has some tips on that, but it's the biggest thing is getting the dogs to leave your side and then getting all the way across. Once they get across, you're 50% there. Now you got to get that duck back. So I've seen a lot of dogs go out at the honor because they don't have that trust. And when you're training for it, you got to make sure that dog is successful every time. Every time it comes back to you, it's coming back with a duck. And every time you're sending it out there, it knows that there's a duck across the water there. It takes a lot to get ready for this point in the test. And there's many different things that you can do to get ready, but you also got to do what works for you. A lot of people start out with visuals, whether it be a bucket or flinging a dummy in the air for them to have a sight. But remember, you're not going to have a visual at the test. And then slowly taking that away.
Most people start on land and then move to the water.
Yep. And that's what I had done here too, is started on land, transitioned it. And it worked for me. Even when it was as cold as it was, we were doing, you know, line drills in the snow. And the next thing I know, Summer was here, and it was just last week. I sent her on her first 100-yard, 9-yard blind retrieve without a visual, and she went. But I had laid a lot of foundation with her prior to, like, months of foundation just on land before I transitioned it to water.
Cutting those rows in the snow, or even in the summer when you have tall grasses, mowing those lines just to teach them those basics, fundamentals.
The biggest thing that I see where dogs have failed with people that I've been training with, or people that I've tried to help and they wouldn't listen to me, is their dog gets sick of doing it and they give them live ducks at the end. Well, if you get sick of broccoli and you give them chocolate, they're not going to want the broccoli anymore. And I've seen a few dogs get over there at the blind retrieve and go, "Where's my live duck? Okay, I'm going to leave this one here. We'll see. I'm going to go look for the live duck." Don't ever go to a live duck on the blind retrieve when you're teaching it, because that is just, you're just setting yourself up for failure. But there's a million different ways to teach the blind retrieves, and I'm not even going to get into the different ways I've had to do it. I think I always tell, when I sell puppies to people, or when somebody calls me for training and they want to put their dog in for training, when it's a puppy, where do you want to see your dog in 5 years? In 5 years, what do you want to have accomplished with this dog? And if the invitational is one of them, when we're getting ready for utility and we force fetch, I teach them to do some of the blind retrieve work when I'm force fetching bumpers. I always teach my own personal dogs how to do blind retrieves, like the labs. I teach them the hand signals. Now they're not relying on any visual cues. They're relying solely on me. And that trust and that bond is always there when they listen to those visual cues from me. Every single dog that I've ever taught hand signals to, I've used it wild bird hunting, whether it be to get across water, or whether it be to, maybe I shot a bird and I saw it crawling off onto land that I can't hunt. It is legal for you to pursue those birds. I'd rather not walk on the property if I don't have to, but now I can put the dog under the fence and give it cues with my hands to send the dog certain places for retrieves. I had a situation in an AKC hunt test with my dog that passed the invitational and new hand signals. She had two birds get up, and she was watching the bird the gunners did not decide to shoot. The birds, she was running a master hunt test. The bird that they decided to shoot, she was not following with her eye. I was able to take her a couple steps forward beyond where that other bird was up that she was watching. And she totally took my line, and I gave her a couple hand signals. Without that, I wouldn't have passed that leg of masters. So it helped me in another test teaching that. But if I get a dog in for training and I don't have time to do it, the buckets have worked really well for me too.
Yeah. And when I'm training for the blind, I like to give the visual where I take an eye bolt and I put streamers in it and I give that visual right away. So if I need to give them a mark across that water, I fling it into the air. I only do that a few times in the beginning, especially if dogs that I'm concerned about are maybe popping or not really confident enough to go all the way across. I'll give them that visual. Again, people use swing dummies in the air. People have other people across the water. They have white buckets. They have white flags. Again, you just have to figure out what works best for you. And especially in your training group. And again, every part of this test is like everything NAVDA tries to do. We're trying to set up things that you would run into in a hunting situation, you know, and this is the premier stuff when you have dogs, and it's going all the way back to the beginning when we first started saying, why would we do this? Because, you know, you really can showcase the very best of your dog when you're sending your dog on a blind retrieve because your buddy shot a duck. And his dog can't get it, and it might be a different breed of dog, say not a pointing dog, and your dog has been trained on those blind retrieves, and you say fetch or back, and they go get it. That's pretty dang cool. And that's what a lot of the scenarios that we're setting up for in this test is showcasing, is getting people that hunting dog that when you do go out in those real life situations, you can apply what you're training for and what your dog has learned.
So on that note, a true blind is when you're handling to a bird. So in a retriever test, they are handling to every bird. And in this blind retrieve for NAVDA, you are only allowed or recommended without getting docked to do so many resends or give so many commands or signals. So.
Yes and no, though. But if your dog is taking the commands, I watched a girl probably give, I'd say, 8 to 12 commands to her dog to get them across, but they took every single command. So the dog started out, it popped, looked at him, she said back. It got over to the shore, got way off, she whistled, there's another command. It stopped, looked at her, she said over, she whistled, stopped the dog. Then she said over again, got the dog into the scent cone of the bird, and it brought the bird all the way back to her, and she got a 4 in her blind because the dog took every single command, and it was an impressive show what she did. Now, on the flip side of that, you bring your dog in, you say back, and they start across, and then they come all the way back. Even when you say back and you try to get them to go, they come all the way back to you, and then you get another resend. And it just depends on those judges how many times they're going to let you try to get your dog across. But generally, if they don't go that first or second time, they're probably not going to go.
Okay. Yeah, so I had that wrong. I thought you could only use commands and signals so many times. So you are able to actually over to the bird
as long as they listen. You can give as many commands as you want to. If they listen, it's when they come back and give up and you have to resend them, you only have 2 sends. Okay. But you can handle them all the way across if you need to. If they get off course and you want to put them back on course, then they'll actually listen. Now the scary part of it is the farther they get away from you, then when you start giving them commands and handling and they're nervous about where they are and what's going on and in a new place, sometimes it's scary because sometimes they'll come back when you start giving them too many commands.
How much time can they spend over on the other side? If you're not giving commands or signals and the dog's just kind of running up and down the bank, they know something is over there, but they're just not getting into that scent cone. Is there a certain amount of time that they're only allowed over there till the judges say, just call them back?
I would say unless they're getting way off course. And my instructions to the handler would be like, if the dog gets over there and it's, say, to the left of the bird and the scent, where they drop the scent in the water and the dog is going way left, my suggestion would be, instead of calling the dog back, my suggestion would be to try to handle the dog if they can. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I've ever had somebody call their dog back in because the dog did not get the bird.
Okay.
I have seen it where dogs have went across and that went into a full duck search. And that's not good either. It's got to be within a reasonable amount of time, right, because there is other dogs that need to test. So if they're going into a full duck search and, like Tracy said, they can't handle the dog over to the scent where the dog or the duck has been dropped, the judges are going to call it by that point and tell you just to call your dog back, and you'll have failed that part of the test, unfortunately. But the idea is to get that duck search out of them. So there's a lot of people that are confident that their dogs know the difference between a duck search and a blind retrieve. For me personally, unless I know my dog can handle it, I'm not going to run them on a duck search at all. I'm strictly doing blinds because I want to get duck searches out of their head and get them to understand to go straight across, find something, and come right back. And again, a lot of those dogs that go into that search mode, they give them some time to get out of it and get into that scent cone of the duck, but within reason, because again, there's only so much time in a day and there's other people that have to test.
A lot of things that some handlers will, or some dog owners will, qualify them for the invitational. And then the year they're supposed to be preparing for the invitational, they'll take and run a utility to re-qualify for the next year. Say they're qualified. Say they got a prize one last year in 2020 and they're preparing for the 2021 invitational. While they're preparing for the 2021 invitational, they'll run a utility that year so that if they fail at the invitational, they're all qualified for the next invitational in 2022. I think that's really rough on the dogs, because now instead of just doing, four jobs and practicing those four jobs, now they're having to do 18 jobs. I think it's something like that. So now, like you said, it's really confusing for them to go do a duck search and then come back and do a blind retrieve. So I think people should put more effort into just making the dogs pass the invitational, worry about requalifying the dog if it doesn't pass the test. I think they're putting too much pressure on their dogs. My own personal opinion.
Mm-hmm. I agreed. And that's how we do it too. I actually do have my dog that I'm running the invitational this year signed up for a utility test after the invitational. So we will have to then train that duck search back into her, but it's after.
A lot of the retriever trainers wear long sleeve white shirts when they train and when they test, sometimes even the white
gloves.
Those are
field trialers. I worked for a lab kennel for 2 years, so I know all about this. In the AKC hunt test for retrievers, they have to wear a green or a purple or a brown shirt. So they cannot wear a white shirt.
Okay.
Because those retrieves are supposed to be more in your hunting length that you normally would hunt and normally it would shoot across the way. In the retriever dog field trials, they do wear white. So because those retrieves are 300 yards instead of 60 to 70 yards. Okay. So they have to see from a lot farther away. And that's why they wear light color.
Yeah. So what's your feeling on that?
What color you're wearing, if they're only 50, 60, 100 yards away, they can see you.
Okay. Well, even like when you're in the field portion and you have, you know, the judges around, you have groups of people, do you feel like wearing white as the handler would help your dog decipher which one you are?
I think you need to wear the same color clothing that you wear during training. Have you ever walked in a room with a different hat on? How's your dog reacted to it? Your dog's not used to wearing a hood. How's the dog reacted to it? It's been different, right? because dogs used to how you stance, your stance. They're used to your body language and how you stand up and how you move. They actually recognize you by your body language and how you move rather than what you're wearing.
And they can smell you. They know who you are. I wear white. I probably do it because everybody else does, but I also train with white on too. Especially when I'm doing blinds, I'll have a white t-shirt on or something like that. But I've seen professional trainers, people that have done this test a whole heck of a lot more than I have, just wear a neutral color. Just like Tracy said, I don't think there's really that much emphasis on it that some put on it. Again, it's what your comfort level is and what your dog's used to. Again, you have to have that bond with your dog. They have to trust you to do the task, no matter how many people are out there. I mean, when you're hunting, you want that dog to bring that bird back to you too. So are you wearing white when you're hunting? I don't. I mean, I wear white.
Camo, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I wear white because I think it might give me a little bit of an advantage.
I agree. But I do wear lighter colored clothes when I'm running a dog. Not so, I don't know if it's so much that the dog can see me, but it's cooler. You know, most of your shirts that are designed to wear in hot weather will be lighter colored. And so if you wear a dark blue shirt, I don't care how light it is, you're going to be hot. So, I have a tendency to wear lighter clothes because that's the way they come. That's what you want to wear.
Right. And I don't know. I mean, as an invitational judge, is that something that's mentioned to you guys as judges' etiquette of don't
wear white?
Is there anything else in the blind retrieve that you guys wanted to touch on?
When you heel over to the honor, I don't know if you're kind of considering that to be part of the blind retrieve or if you're considering that to be part of the honor. We know your dog just swam 200 yards. It's not quite as strict of heeling as it is at the actual heeling portion of the test. So if your dog needs to take a leak on something, shake off, get its wits about you, if you're heeling over and all of a sudden you get a few steps, you know, if you put them at heel and you get a few steps away and they shake off, just kind of lightly tap your leg and keep walking and have them come back to heel. It's under cooperation and obedience is what that's under. So if your dog is cooperative and obedient everywhere else, chances are it'll be fine. If you're lacking in cooperation and obedience, you know, then it can take you down a little bit, but we don't really get too uptight about it.
And, you know, Tracy's right on there. I didn't realize that as a first-time handler, and Tracy was actually my judge when I was getting ready from the blind to the honor. And as she came out of the blind, I mean, she barely shook off. And I was like, heel! And I was, like, really tough on her. And Tracy goes, it's not the healing part of the test. Geez, I about healed the way I said it so far. You know, so, and I didn't realize that because I thought I was healing.
You're not carrying a gun either.
Oh, okay.
You don't carry a gun either at that portion. You're just healing the dog.
Yeah, so I was all concerned it was healing. And it still is a big part of the test. It's that cooperation and obedience. But it's not quite as stringent on it as, you know, you don't want them running ahead of you. You don't want them running off searching. They got to be next to you. But I was pretty sure that I was going to fail that part going from what, you know, the blind over to the honor because I, you know, she had to heal throughout the entire day.
Yep. If you have to give them a few light commands, that's fine. We understand they just swam 200 yards. But practice that. You know, practice healing that long bit. And, you know, where we practice here at my kennel, it's not a very long walk between the honor and the blind. Unless I make it. So instead of putting the honor right next to the blind release spot, my pond is 70 yards across. I'll put one on the other side of the pond and I'll heel around the pond. Sometimes you're heeling next to water. Sometimes you're heeling between trees. Sometimes we had to change it because of the way the wind was blowing. One time in Ohio. So we kind of had to make our own path and it wasn't such a good path as the one that was pre-made for us, and there were some things in the way, and so we had to kind of not in the way, but there were some spots of our healing path that were a little tighter, and there were some trees sticking up. So, you know, if they're going to take a leak on things in training, just don't let them. And so in the test, if they do, just tell them no and keep going, you know. Be smart about it. If you see a tree coming up, maybe shuffle to the right a little bit so it doesn't get so close to the tree, you know? So.
Yeah, it's the obedience part of it.
Yep. And it's something I think we forget about too, just in the nerves that are going through us of the day of forgetting to potty our dogs. We're pulling them right out of the vehicle straight, you know, especially when you show up to the double mark or the blind and they say, you're on the line, you're next. And you see, so you're just pulling the dog out of the vehicle and going right to the line and you're forgetting that part to potty them. All right. So you've healed over to the honor by blind. What does this sequence look like?
There's a winger that's going to be out of sight. There's the dog by the water's edge that's going to make your retrieve. Now, you got to keep in mind, we try to switch dogs, that, believe it or not, and they start being naughty, your retrieving dog. They start bringing it closer to the other dog. They start going slow. Sometimes they'll drop it a couple times, and the guy's got to give a couple of commands, you know. They try to give a couple of light commands so it's not too loud for your dog. You put your dog on a mark that's not too close to the water, but it's, you know, it's right up there. I guess it is close to the water. I don't want to say that it's not too close to the water because it is. But you put your dog there, and then you are stand behind your dog in the mark that you're positioned at. And you're a good, I'm not real good at yardage, but you're a good 10, 15, sometimes 20 yards behind your dog. It's a good distance. And then there again, get your dog used to a winger because they're going to throw it out of a winger. So they throw it out of the winger, out into the water. Your dog, that's your retrieving dog, makes the retrieve, and your dog has to sit there until the judges tell you to get your dog, which will be when that retrieving dog brings back the retrieve. And then you have to heel out off lead. You don't have a gun in your hand at this point, and this is again part of your cooperation and obedience. And the healing, there's like a, usually they spray paint a line or an X, and you just heel over there, and then you can put your leash on. And that's usually, if I remember right, about 20, 25 yards, 30 yards maybe, that they have you heel away, and then you're done.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Again, you want to have your dog used to being close to a water's edge, away from you. Like Tracy said, you are back some distance. If you think your dog is going to move or to break once that retrieving dog comes right in front of them, don't be afraid to use a command. Because sometimes
I think they heard me in Steubenville in Ohio.
What's that, Tracy?
I think when I was in Ohio, they probably heard me in Steubenville, which is about 50 miles away.
Yeah, because once they go in the water, it's over. So if you can stop them, it's a good thing, because usually they're going to take it, the dogs. And the ones that are going to break, they're going to all out break. But practice this. Practice putting your dogs literally on water's edge and another dog running in front of them. And this is great if you have a young dog that's really uncooperative, that takes a bird and parades around and doesn't really retrieve that well, because it's really going to tempt your dog. Because that potentially, you know, you're not going to have those dogs at the test, but it's going to get them to the level that they're just going to be immune to it. When I tested for it, my dog was so sick of it the entire time. When I put her in the circle, I said, whoa, she just looked at me because she knew what was happening. She looked at me the entire time. She didn't even watch the bird come out of the winger. She didn't watch the other dog retrieve it. She just looked at me because she knew that she couldn't move or I was going to bust her. And I was mean mugging her the entire time. And I was so ready to pounce on her, you know what, if she even stuffed a toenail outside that circle. And you can do that. You can say that command. You can get a 3 at the honor and still pass it. And like Tracy says, once that retrieving dog goes back, the judges say, okay, go to your dog, heal him out, you know, 25 yards at best. And that part of the test is done. Mm-hmm. A lot of obedience, a ton.
Not put them on a down, pass the test. You have to either make them whoa or make them sit. Now, if they lay down as the work is happening, it's not a big deal. I'm probably going to mark them down a little bit in desire, on that portion of the test. Probably it's not going to amount to anything because your desire, hopefully in the field, is good enough, but you cannot bring them up there and put them on a down. You have to make them sit or stay. They feel that that command makes them too stationary. This is a breaking test. That's what it is. And like Angie said, when I'm training for it, I guarantee my dogs are closer to that retrieve than the retrieving dog is during training. Because then if you train for the hard, it to be really hard on the dog, when you get to the test and it's a little easier, they go, oh, I can handle this. Hopefully. You got to remember, throughout the day, these dogs get tired in any testing, whether it be AKC hunt test, NA test, a utility test. If you run your dogs VGP, VJP in the German system, or at the Invitational, they get tired. They're in and out of the truck and they're doing different things. And, you know, if you're not at the honor and blind in the morning, your dog is going to run for that hour in the field and they're going to be tired. Sun's hitting them, or maybe it's, you know, hot, or we had one Invitational that it was cold at in Ohio. So it just all depends on, it may be raining, it may be crappy weather. You have to prepare for all things. And the mental tiredness is one thing you guys can prepare for. One thing that when I first started running my own dogs that I never thought about was the mental tiredness of the dog. And if this is going to be your last event for the day, when these dogs get tired, they don't want to concentrate and they're not up to their best level. Think about it when we get tired. Sometimes can't remember how to tie your shoe, you know, so dogs are the same way. So I always recommend to people, every once in a while, take your dog, get together with a group of people and do a mock test and run these dogs through the entire test. Even if it's not a full hour in the field and, you know, a 100-yard blind retrieve, say you're going to maybe run 45 minutes in the field or a half hour in the field with each dog. And then you're going to go on to doing a 50-60-yard blind and the honor and a double mark. Maybe you don't have a pond that's big enough to get your full double marks, but just every single portion of the test and make them concentrate and never run it in the same order. When you practice it in a couple more weeks, maybe try doing the water work first on one. And then maybe the next time you run it, maybe try doing the field work first on that day. So always mix it up. Never let the dog know what you're going to do.
Yep. You can bet Labor Day weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday, I'm going to be running a mock test every day. I'm going to push them. I'm going to try to get it with a group of people. And I pretty much personally, once after Labor Day, I'm done. If they either have it or they don't. I don't generally take birds with me. It is what it is. They've got to have it or they don't. Labor Day is a good benchmark for me. Once I've gone through that weekend, I should have worked out all the bugs. And you don't want to get them bored. You don't want them peeking too early. You've got to know your dog. There's going to be a point where, you know, if my dog's already doing 100-yard blind retrieve without a visual, I told it to a friend of mine who's a NAVDA judge, and he says, well, now you got a fine line. You got to figure out to still make it fun for her because it's May and she's doing 100-yard blind retrieve. Now, some people think that's great, but yet she can get super bored with it and she could screw me that day. So you really got to know your dog, know when they're peaking, know that fine line, you know, work on the things that you need to. And, you know, I might the week before the test do basic obedience, a little bit of healing, maybe do a bird barrage when I take all my homing pigeons out and throw them at her, do some wild flushes, stop to flushes. But that's about it. Because by that point, you don't want to be creating any bad habits either.
No, I completely agree. I think that you can bore these dogs with this stuff. And if they got their dogs out and they're doing it all perfect right now, I guarantee by test time, they're not gonna. I never have taken birds to me and trained at the test ground with birds. I may take my dog out and run it. I'll do basic obedience. Maybe I'll take some dead birds or some bumpers and do some stop to flushes with a blank pistol. Do some fun and light. I don't stop training before the test, but I don't do complicated things. But if they're used to being trained every day, then it's just another day for the dog. It's just another training day when you get to the test. So I may, like Angie said, I'll save all my big workouts, all my hour long runs and everything else for, you know, but a couple weeks before the test or a week before the test, I change it to short runs, easy backing, easy situations. If I'm having difficulty with something still, because you got to keep in mind, I'm busy training everybody else's dogs. So when I do train my own dogs, sometimes I don't get as much time with my own dogs. Sometimes I'll still be working on a few things, but I try not to get into any arguments because I usually don't have time to win them before the test.
Yeah. And with blinds, my final blind is usually, I mean, I have a duck that I dispatch right there in the parking lot, and it's a shorter blind. By then I've already done the big blinds. I've done the big 125 yards, 150 yards. This is a fun one. And, you know, she may be only doing 60 yards, and we send her across and lots of praise, and that's it. That's the very last blind I will do with her before her
test.
We
learned our lesson on one of our invitational dogs. We were trying to make them during the summer. We were trying to make them do one of the ponds that we were using was 300 yards across. And what forcing him across 300 yards of water did was it made him not like ducks. And eventually he started to chew the head off. So don't do that. So if they'll go 70 or 80 or 90 yards, they'll go 100 yards.
Yep.
The effects of too much pressure with any portion of this test or just boring them can take you so far backwards, it's going to be hard to recover, especially if it's happening right now.
Absolutely. Yeah. It is a fine line.
I try at all costs not to use the e-collar, and every dog training is like a roadmap. You can all take a different road and end up in the same place. But I've seen the e-collar for backing training be so detrimental. I think it teaches them to blink the other dog. Now, I'll use it if I have no other choice, but I try using other methods. Besides, that's always my last thing that I try if I'm really having problems with them backing is to use the e-collar. It's like pointing. It has to be an instinct. It has to be, they're up there all by themselves and you don't have any control, you know? Mm-hmm. So in order to make that instinct come out, it's hard to force it. You have to make use natural ways like stop to flushes and things like that. Make them think they're scaring the bird away. They're kind of like teenagers that way. If they think you're arguing with them, they're just going to argue more. If they think they cause the problems, they'll go fix it right away.
What about that, since we're talking about it, the blind portion, you know, you're out there trying to make it fun, doing the fundamentals, but then at what point do you turn that into, you know, that method? If you've put a forced retrieve on a dog and you're driving them to a pile, will you ever use that e-collar to drive them across a blind?
The only reason I use an e-collar is to make them not go. Hold on. The one part of the NAVDA training book, if you guys have ever read that, it talks about doing drags. And in one portion of that book, it says if your dog never, ever refuses a drag during training, take a rope, attach it to a branch up in a tree, and have a helper pull the bird out of reach of the dog. So that it comes back with nothing. You discipline it, probably not hard, maybe lightly, because it's your fault that it didn't do it. But the dog receives some sort of discipline to figure out what happens if they don't go. So all of your training throughout any test that you're ever preparing this dog for, or if you're just preparing it for hunting, all training is trying to make your dog make a mistake in a controlled environment so that you can get away and teach it how to do the job properly. So if your dog won't pop or if it won't refuse to go to the pile, that's when I worked at the lab kennel, that's what they would do when you were doing your piles, is they would use the collar to make it and the whole reason for that is to make it not go so that it learns what happens when it refuses to go.
Where do you find that the most dogs fail? Which portion of the test?
Fine. Depends on the dog.
Yeah.
So I'm going to be pointing. Do you have any statistics on that?
We used to long ago, and the majority of it has been the blind and the backing. Really? That's where they're.
That'd probably be what I would have picked. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which portions of the test do dogs need a 4 to pass?
They need a 4 in pointing, nose, and desire. And remember, your nose, desire, cooperation, and obedience is throughout the entire day. So at the end of the day, the field judges and your blind judges and your double mark judges are all getting together and they're talking about your dog and they're consensing on the nose, desire, cooperation, and obedience. So you need a 4 in your nose, you need a 4 in your desire, and you need a 4 in pointing. So by the time everybody comes together, that's why it can be such a long day. I mean, you can expect to really be there from sun up to sundown. Because there's so much that can happen, that variables where the water people come back a little later. Just because you're done with your day, we need all those judges to come back and consent over every single dog and decide, is this a versatile champion dog based on the scores throughout the day? So overall scores, again, are judged throughout the day through nose, desire, cooperation, and obedience. That's got to be in everybody's mind that it's looked at throughout the entire day.
Why is it only a pass or fail? Why is this portion in the NAVDA testing system not scored out like the other ones are?
Well, it's pass, fail, and it isn't. You know, you have to earn... you only need three places where you need a 4, you know, to pass the test. So you do have to earn the scores in each category. It's just you can't ever have a 2 in anything to pass. So it's a higher level of scoring that needs to happen. Mm-hmm. So because you do always get a number, even if you fail or you pass, you still get a number. It's just that you need the 3s and 4s in the right places to pass the test. I guess where it differs is you don't get different prizes.
Okay.
If you get all the 3s and 4s in the right places, then you pass the test.
Whether I have a VC that passed with 200 points or 186 points, nobody talks about the points.
I have 186er. You know what? At the end of the day, he was a VC. And it was the worst day he'd ever had, ever, and he still passed.
And I have a 200 and I have one that's 196, but you know what? In the end, they're all VCs and that number may be on their pedigree somewhere in the NAVDA system. But when you talk to people and we all love to brag about our dogs, including myself, I say I have a versatile champion, or I say I have 3 versatile champions in my kennel. Nobody asks what that score is at the end, just whatever it takes to get there, to get that VC title. Is what's important for me.
Well, of all the dogs that have qualified and are running for this year, we can find those all on the NAVDA website. If people are interested in going to the Invitational to at least watch it, take notes and see what it would all entail in person, because we can only cover so much here verbally and kind of walking through it.
I have one more comment that I just thought of, Courtney.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking about preparation of your dog and running with different dogs and seeing who you need to run with. You can know by looking at those lists. You just reminded me when you brought that up. You can know what breeds of dogs you're running with. You won't know the running order. You won't know who you're running with, but you'll at least know what breeds of dogs are running on the day that you're running, so that you'll know which breeds of dogs maybe to pair your dog with to practice.
Right. Yep.
Yeah, and I do want to give one other plug. You know, go to the NAVDA.org website, and actually Tracy is going to be conducting Invitational Handlers Clinic with me at my kennel here in the middle of June, and just today we had 2 people drop, so this was full. This is pretty new to NAVDA, having an Invitational Handlers Clinic. We actually have some people coming from all over Montana coming to this clinic, and we just had 2 spots open up, and Tracy will be the clinic leader for that. So if anybody is interested in that, by the time that this would be publicized to people, just check out the Wisconsin River Chapter NAVDA website, and you'll get a really chance to go over everything that Tracy's talked about, Tracy and I have talked about today, and then we'll be doing some visuals in the field, so you can actually see what it looks like for a backing dog and what are you looking at and pointing. And it's a handler's clinic, and we're going to go do blinds and we're going to go do double marks. So
great,
even if it's not this year, but next year,
Hopefully there's more chapters that hold invitational handlers clinics, and, you know, the clinic leader judges are going to be very well versed in the invitational as well and be able to go through a lot of what we've talked about and give some visuals. So try to get into handlers clinics, even if in the future you're looking to do it, because I think it's something that's going to be very beneficial to the members down the road. And just keep looking at that NAVDA website calendar for when those handler clinics would be.
And that AIMS clinic doesn't cover the VC level, does it?
A little bit. Just a little bit of it does.
Okay.
Not very much. Just a little bit at the end. We kind of, when we were talking about in the classroom about utility, I guess I can't speak for other clinic leaders. Get your head out of the way. I touch a little bit on the invitation, but we don't spend a whole lot of time on it. If you know what the judges are looking for and what they're expecting, you're going to know how to better train your dog and prepare it for the test. And like I said, you know, training is like a roadmap. You can all take a different road and get to the same place. So take what you learn. If you apply anything to your dog 6 or 7 times, whatever technique it is, whatever, if you want to change something that you're training or if your technique that you're using, if you try something with a dog 6 or 7 times and they're not getting it at least 60 or 70% of what you're teaching, means you either bit off too much, more than you can chew. You need to maybe less, you know, go in shorter steps, or you need to figure out a different way to teach it to your dog. But in 6 or 7 times, would you agree with me, Angie? They should be getting at least 60 or 70% of what you're teaching. So go to these things. If you go to a handler's workshop for the invitational, it's something new, something we're trying. There's going to be people there showing you how to do some of the training, using some of their techniques. You know, if you try it with your dog, don't just try it once. Try it 6 or 7 times. And then if it don't work, you know, move on to a different technique. But I hope to show people a little bit on how to work their dogs. If we can work with their own personal dogs, we're going to try. They're actually going to be out there on Saturday, and they're actually going to be having a scorecard in their hand, and they're actually going to be judging like you would judge at the Invitational.
Awesome.
Yeah, and let's remember just the fact that the Invitational is a hard test to train for, and generally less than 50% of the dogs that go pass the test. Again, like I said in the beginning, I've seen this test bring grown men and women to their knees, professional trainers, novice trainers. You know, a lot of people put a lot of heart and soul and finances into this, because we all know our dogs can do it, or we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't put ourselves through it to get us to that point. Again, it's one day that you're under judgment that we decide if your dog is a versatile champion or not, and if your dog has earned that versatile champion title, I should say more so. So just be proud to the fact that you've made it and you've trained to that. To this point, you have a phenomenal dog. You're playing with the big guys. You're in the Super Bowl here when you're at the NAVDA Invitational and you're running your dog. So pass or fail, I just hope people are really proud of the fact that they're there and they did all the work to that point, and then try to have fun with it. We all get nervous. We all been there. I probably throw up a couple times just before I even go to the line because I know how much it means to me, and it means to the dog, and how much I've put into it. You know, I'm judging dogs a lot less this year so I can train for the Invitational because I know that it takes that much work. So again, it's a hard test. It's a very hard test, but it's doable, and NAVDA is a good community to get it done and to move forward in our testing system.
When you look on paper, it doesn't seem like that much, does it?
What's that?
When you look at the test, all of what's involved, all the, you know, healing, double mark, bind retrieve, honor, and field. So there's 5 things that you have to do. But it's at such a different obedience level that it puts a lot of pressure on these dogs. And when you look at it on paper, you go, oh, I only got to do 5 different tasks. Well, yeah, it's a lot. It doesn't seem like it is, but it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just be proud you're there and you're doing it.
Yeah. And something we haven't done in the other episodes, Angie, I wanted to touch on because I know how important it is at every NAVDA test, you guys like to mention the sponsors that support the organization and all the testing that are going on. Did you guys want to run through those?
You know what I always tell people at a test? You got to buy the stuff anyway, so you might as well buy it from the people that support what we love and what we do. You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know that our sponsors typically are, Purina, Ugly Dog, Dakota 283, Garmin Tritronics. Our conservation partners are Rough Grouse Society, Quail and Pheasant Forever. Are there any, I know there's probably some more that just support the Invitational, like where we Brown hold L's it, things like that. Brownell.
Yep. Big so star. Brownells is an event sponsor, and this year we're able to bring on Cabela's as an event sponsor.
Oh, that's awesome. That's exciting.
Yep. Cool. So that they'll be helping to supply things for handlers, judges, and volunteers. And Purina as well is stepping up this year and adding some extra stuff to help out and defray some of the costs, but actually making it a great experience overall for the handlers and the volunteers, because at this event, there's nobody that's getting paid to do it. Everybody that's there is volunteering, from the person making your meal all the way up to, you know, the judges and the judges running the test and, you know, Deb Stott, the test secretary. You know, there's countless and hundreds of hours that are put into this leading up to and during. And you think about it, you know, this is a 7-day test and you've got people taking an entire week off, you know, and there's, you know, even though judges may rotate through, you've got, you know, Gary Engelbretson, who is our equipment manager. He's there all week. Mike Nadusky, our test secretary, is there all week. Deb Stott, you know, she's the manager of the entire invitation, the program manager. She's there all week. And Annie Noose, our volunteer coordinator, she's there all week as well. These four individuals are taking off an entire week just to make sure that we have an invitational to run and that everything runs smoothly. And then you have all the judges that'll be rotating. And there's quite a few judges that are going to be there the entire week too. So it really is a volunteer and a love for the dog that we're all going to be there. So if anybody ever gets a chance to volunteer again, you're volunteering at the Super Bowl of dog events, just go to the NAVDA website and sign up to volunteer.
Hey, I'm sorry that I can't be there for all the handlers this year. And I want to thank all of my fellow judges that have stepped up and volunteered to judge, and thank all the volunteers that are signed up or about to sign up. And I just want to wish all the handlers good luck.
Yep. Very good luck and congratulations for getting this far and being there.
Getting that far. Yep. Definitely.
You deserve it. VC or no VC, congratulations.
Yep, exactly.
Thank you, ladies. This was awesome. I'm really sad to be ending this series with the NAVDA testing. It's been a lot of fun. And I know people are getting a ton of information out of it. So I appreciate all that you do as judges and volunteer extraordinaires. And Tracy, I think that's really cool that you are fulfilling mom duties and taking that role this year. I know that balance and how dedicated you are, and being a mom in all of this is certainly.
I only have 3 more years with her, so I'm gonna do as much as I can, but I'm gonna miss everybody at the invitation. I'll be back the next year, so yeah.
Thanks, Courtney, for doing this series. This was awesome, and I do think a lot of people are gonna get a lot out of it, and they already have. I've already just got a text message while I was sitting here talking to you today about somebody's like, could you send me that podcast for the utility one you just did? I'm getting ready to run the test and I want to listen to it, you know, so hopefully it's helping people. And so thank you for, you know, sponsoring and showcasing NAVDA and everything that we're doing for the dog world. Yeah. You know, our membership is growing so much, and the more we can help our members, the better off everybody's going to be and want to stay involved.
Absolutely. All right. You ladies have a great night. Great rest of the testing and training year.
Yeah, Tracy, you too. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bird Dog Babe podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, share it and tag me and someone that would benefit from listening. And hey, help a girl out by giving the podcast a rating and review on whichever platform you're listening from. Send me a screenshot of your review and I'll mail you out a Bird Dog Babe sticker. Be sure to join me on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. And if you're interested in some Bird Dog Babe swag or gear that I rely on, be sure to check out the store on thebirddogbabe.com. And most importantly, don't forget to support the sponsors of this podcast and the organizations that are working hard to conserve the birds you're chasing after and the public lands in which you hunt.